Welcome back to the Hollywood Casino Press Box featuring Frank Cusimano and Martin Kilcoin on 590 The Fan and 590thefan.com.
Maryville is one of our fine sponsors. Go to maryville.edu for more information about that great school. Each new student is assigned a life coach, knowledgeable resource for academic advising, mentoring, campus networking, career guidance, and all things Maryville. Diagnostics utilized by Maryville University's life coaches help students understand their individual learning styles.
Going to talk to Lester Munson. We had the commissioner, Rick Hummel. These are some of the true veteran sports writers out there, Frank. Getting the savvy experience. Frank and I like those who have been around for a little while. And Lester's also a Cubs fan, so we'll remind him they're 11 games under 500 on the road. They lost last night in San Francisco, so the Cardinals wake up today half game, just a half game out of first place in the National League Central.
I wonder if Lester was up late last night watching that debacle by the Cubs.
Lester was not up last night watching the debacle. Lester knows that with the Cubs, bad things happen in the seventh, eighth, and ninth inning, and so he retired before he knew that would happen. Yeah.
Here's a question for Lester Munson. Great legal mind, but also diehard Cubs fan. And I asked Frank this earlier. I said, who's the Cubs manager in 2020? We kicked it around a little bit. We came up with Joe Girardi, but the sense is that it's just not going to be Joe Maddon. Is that your sense?
That certainly is the prevailing feeling. I don't think it makes any sense. Girardi would be a good manager, but Joe Maddon, he wins 95 games a year. He is an entertaining and delightful guy. He's fantastic with the media here in Chicago, and I'm not quite sure why the Cubs management has grown tired of him. To me, he's... Pure oxygen. He gets the best out of these guys. He does. There's no question. He does do some weird and crazy things with the pitching staff, but that would seem to me to be something you could work with. Or how about if Theo Epstein gets them a couple of pitchers who can throw strikes in contrast to the current crop?
Who would win a popularity contest in Chicago, Theo Epstein or Joe Maddon?
That is a really interesting question, Frank. I would say probably Theo, when you've had no pennant for 108 years and no World Series, and you produce that carries you for 4 or 5 years. So he's still in the honeymoon period. Joe Maddon has to pick out who's going to pitch in the ninth inning, and that frequently is a disaster for the Cubs. So, yeah, Epstein would probably win the contest, but it would be something like, you know, with 54%. It would not be an overwhelming landslide win.
When and why did that relationship start to crumble a little bit? Is it because Joe's not an analytics guy as much as Theo? I mean, Joe seems to be an agreeable guy. He doesn't seem to be a cantankerous manager. He seems like he'd get along with people. What went wrong there?
I'm not sure. I don't think it's the analytics. I think Theo is happy to take care of all of that himself, and Maddon does use a lot of the metrics that he is given, and he certainly encourages his pitchers and catchers to pay attention to the scouting reports to understand what's going on. He just benched Addison Russell because he couldn't even keep up with the signals. So Maddon has, I think, a very firm outlook. I don't know what happened here, but we knew about this maybe in January, December or January, when Epstein did not extend Madden's contract. And at that point, it became, you know, kind of wait and watch, and is he a lame duck, and what's going on? And unless they get deep into the playoffs, which is a very questionable scenario right now, I'm afraid Maddon will be gone, and Girardi or Mark Loretta, those are the two who are both of them graduates of Northwestern University, incredibly, here in the Chicago area. So, yeah, one of them will be the new manager.
It is amazing how the script has flipped. In St. Louis, I think there's just sort of an anticipation, a hope, get back to October. And I think the fan base is just desperate to see a playoff game. And in Chicago, the way it used to be here was, if you don't get to the World Series or an NLCS, I mean, what is the bar there, do you think, in terms of not just Madden, but maybe even the fan base, what they would quote-unquote accept as a good year?
I think if you get to that's a really good observation, because at one time we were happy to be 500, you know, not so long ago. So now I think you've got to get in the NLCS before fans are going to be happy. Keep in mind, however, the place is packed for every game, 39, 40,000 people, so that it's a successful business regardless, but the fans have much higher expectations. It's kind of embarrassing, really. I used to think, if we could just get in the playoffs, I'll be happy. Then, of course, you want to win in the playoffs. Then you want to go deep in the playoffs. Then you want to be in the World Series. It's never enough, and it's kind of embarrassing to even say that, but that's exactly what happens to Cub fans, and I think the fans anywhere where a team is building some success.
All right, let's get to some legal things. The U.S. women's soccer controversy about equal pay. We all thought it was a great story. We were all rooting for the women, but if the men are bringing in billions of dollars from their World Cup and the women are bringing in hundreds of millions of dollars, it's a no-brainer, right? Do they have? Can this lawsuit work for them?
I think that this lawsuit will work for them. The lawyer who is handling the case is Jeff Kessler. He has had fantastic success representing players in football, basketball, and even in college sports. He's a terrific lawyer. I think he has the right theory this time. He will try to set those economics to one side. He will present it more as a kind of a human rights situation. He does have a wonderful target in this case in the U.S. soccer organization. When the women came back to New York for the ticker tape parade, the president of U.S. soccer could not even pronounce Megan Rapinoe's name correctly. He mispronounced it twice. I mean, these guys, they should be trying to settle with the women. They should not be contesting it. There's plenty of money to go around. They can easily afford to equalize the per diems and the pay and the other benefits. And, no, I think the women are going to do okay.
And on our old friends in the NFL, we've talked about lawsuits. We still got one going here in St. Louis, but the Oakland City lawsuit against the Raiders in play right now. Federal judge nearly dismissed the city of Oakland's lawsuit against the Raiders. They gave the city 45 days to provide new evidence in this case. Where do you see this one headed?
Well, that case is different from the St. Louis case. It's an antitrust theory, and there's a serious technical problem with the Oakland theory. In order to pursue antitrust relief, treble damages or an injunction or any kind of relief based on monopolistic behavior, you have to have what is called standing. And the judge has figured out that the only standing Oakland has at the moment, the only right that they have to pursue this case, is based on loss of tax revenue. And the law, the antitrust law, is pretty clear that that's not enough to be a plaintiff and to succeed and to have standing that you need to succeed in an antitrust case. Oakland lawyers will be scrambling now to figure out a way to establish some sort of standing. It's kind of weird because if you go back in history, the Oakland Raiders were suing the NFL for antitrust about twice a year for about 8 years under Al Davis, and they generally had some success, not always. But now the standing question is a serious problem. The United States government, Department of Justice, under President Trump, has intervened in the case, and they're attacking the Oakland position. So, yeah, I think Oakland has a serious problem. The St. Louis case is based on different legal theories that have a good chance to work. But this, that they do have a problem there. There's no question.
Okay, on the St. Louis one, there's so many different elements to this interesting court drama, which is going to happen. But what about this angle? If you have the Kevin Demoff, Stan Kroenke's right-hand man, saying right after that piece of land was bought in L.A., he said something like, you know, he's an investor. He's always looking at land. That's not exactly, you know, NFL property. And then after, you know, the move is made, that big article in the L.A. Times, Kevin Demoff saying, I can remember when he bought the land and Stan was out there in the morning saying, this is it. This is our dream. This is where we'll build our stadium. Doesn't that seem like it's going to be pretty incriminating and pretty helpful to St. Louis?
There's no question about it. I think Demoff went so far as to say this piece of property is not fit for a stadium. And then within a short period of time, they're saying it's the dream location. That is the kind of misrepresentation, the kind of mendacity that goes a long way with a jury. If St. Louis can move the case to a jury, that's not a given. If they can, that is the kind of thing that is going to produce a verdict for St. Louis and against Kroenke and the Rams and the National Football League. There's no question about it. The misrepresentations and the inconsistencies from Kroenke, from Demoff, and then Jeff Fisher saying what he said, that is powerful stuff.
Explain
no
that.
About it.
Explain the Fisher comments.
Fisher came along, and let me get Fisher came along and said, as he hold on.
You could be going back. Was it the interview process where he said he was asked about a potential move? There was some reporting on that.
He said, I was fortunate to have some options. I decided on Los Angeles or St. Louis at the time, knowing there was going to be a pending move. He said that in December of 2016, as he was being hired. Why did he take this, the Rams job, as opposed to other? He was the flavor of the month back then. It's kind of hard to remember that now, but
Miami. He had offers from Miami and St. Louis, and I think the December of 16 would have been after L.A. fired him. And I think he's talking then because he's a little bitter, basically saying, hey, I was brought in to get us here, and now they're firing me. I think that's when that all came out.
He's describing how he made the decision to go to St. Louis, knowing that there was going to be a pending move and he would be coaching in the glamour capital of the world, Los Angeles. So that's more evidence, you know, for St. Louis as they present this case. The Kroenke, Demoff, and Fisher, those are the kind of witnesses that if you're Kroenke, you want to hide them in Malaysia someplace when the trial starts so that nobody can get them.
You know, and Fisher's interesting because he has no love lost for Demoff, but he got paid a lot of money by Kroenke, and I don't know what his agreement was on the way out the door, but if he would flip, so to say, that would be fascinating.
Well, and if you're the lawyer for St. Louis, you bring in Fisher. You put him on the stand. He's sworn in to tell the truth. And if he starts going off in a different direction, then the technique that lawyers, that this is pretty routine thing, you make him into a hostile witness, and the judge would probably agree, and then you're allowed to cross-examine him, and you can confront him with what he said in the interview in December of 2016. It's the kind of thing that lawyers look forward to doing, and it's the kind of thing that can turn the case right around.
What do you think the money settlement could be if St. Louis were to win? I know it's a tough question, but just kind of give us a gut feel.
Well, I think I added all this up one time, and I came up with close to $1 billion, counting the various damages that St. Louis would present. There may be problems of proof in there that I have not anticipated, but we're certainly talking hundreds of millions. I would say just to be try to be realistic, try to be conservative, something like $400 or $500 million would be a potential verdict, then you have to defend that in the higher courts. Higher courts tend to reduce these mammoth judgments. But, no, they have a powerful claim based on the lying that went on, and then they have some damage claims that are going to be very interesting.
And who picks that number? Is it the judge?
No, the jury. The jury would decide. Yeah, they would be given a form that when they go back to deliberate, they get what is known as a form of verdict. And that means it's a form that they fill out and that they sign. And there would be a couple questions on there. Do you find from the evidence that St. Louis was wronged and that Kroenke is guilty of misconduct? They fill in yes, and all 6 or 12 of them sign the verdict. And then they say the misconduct resulted in damages to St. Louis of how much? And they would fill in an amount of money and sign that as well. And then when they come out, those would be the verdicts that we would hear sitting in the courtroom.
But that's with a jury. So if they didn't have a jury, then obviously the judge would be the one.
Absolutely.
And this is a jury, and the case is going to be held in St. Louis. You'd think you'd get, you know, a favorable jury for the St. Louis contingent, correct?
There's no question about it. If you're Kroenke in the NFL, you're worried about the fact that you're in St. Louis, as this continues to develop, they will try to move it out of St. Louis. That's not going to happen, I don't think, but they will make an effort to go elsewhere because they know they're going to be in trouble with the citizens of St. Louis who would be on that jury.
This has been very helpful to us, but I also think for Lester, a little time not thinking about his Cubs who are in the tank. This is really, I feel like we've done a little therapy for you on this afternoon.
Yes, you certainly have. You didn't ask me about Pedro Strop or Carl Edwards or some of our other guys who don't know how to throw strikes, but yes.
Hey,
and I hope I've helped you a little.
Real quickly, there was a movie called Runaway Jury with Gene Hackman and Dustin Hoffman just about how, you know, you can get people off a jury or how you can, you know, influence them. How often does that happen that in a big, big lawsuit like this one, where you could get to a juror?
You mean get to a juror to bribe them or get to a juror with persuasive evidence?
Either one.
Well, the days of fixing a jury are pretty well behind us. There was a time, you go back 1920s and 1930s, when the great lawyers would be trying to find a juror and would try to make some arrangement with that juror to vote in favor of that lawyer's position. That was pretty routine for a long time. Even, this is kind of, people don't know this, even Clarence Darrow was once charged with trying to fix a jury. But those days are gone. The court system, if nothing else, protects the jurors from that kind of fixing, that kind of misconduct. But at the same time, the lawyers who try these cases, particularly lawyers representing a plaintiff like St. Louis in this case, they have developed techniques and different kinds of persuasion, and they now understand how to connect with a jury. Frequently, they will use experts, people with graduate degrees in psychology, to study the makeup of the jury, to figure out in advance what kind of argument will work. It's much more scientific, much more sophisticated than it used to be, so that the persuasive skills of the lawyers are vastly better, and the integrity of the jurors is now established, something we did not have, you know, 80 years ago.
Good stuff. We appreciate it, Lester. Thanks so much, sir. We'll talk soon.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you, Martin.
All right, Lester Munson joining us. Boy, he is sharp. He's great.
And I hope we get that trial moment, Fisher Demoff on the forget Big Little Lies and their courtroom showdown in the season finale. This would be must-see TV. They probably wouldn't allow cameras in there, but that would be 1,000% thrilling, wouldn't it, to see these folks having to answer those questions?
It really would be.
And the big question is whether the NFL wants it to get to that point. If other owners, other teams say, listen, are we on the hook? How much are we talking about here? You settle that. If all of a sudden it's cutting into their money around the league, then maybe they'll try and settle this.
I wonder if it's equal because it's against the Rams and the NFL. If, let's just say, they lose $400 million,
if
that's
every
what it is.
Team has to.
Yeah, the Rams pay $200, then the other teams split the other $200 million. I wonder if that's how
you know what
works.
That is, Frank? That's an interesting question. It's not a great question or a good question.
Good observation.
I wrote down good observation and interesting question.
Almost.
Neither put us on the scoreboard with a great question.
Really close, both of us.
This hour also brought to you by our friends at Triad Bank. You can find them on the web at triadbanking.com. Been around since 2005. St. Louis-based bank. If you're a business owner looking to expand, talk to the folks who know how to get things done right here in town. Triad Bank in Frontenac on Clayton Road, one block west of Lindbergh, right off the exit there, Highway 64, and on the web at triadbanking.com.
We'll take a break. We'll be right back.